Many people may not know, but this podcast is produced in Asheville, North Carolina, recently falling victim to Hurricane Helene. This podcast episode was delayed due to that fact, and further episodes may also be delayed. We greatly appreciate your patience and your support. Thank you, and enjoy the episode.
Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story. An epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 3, Audita Tremendi. It's time to return to the Outremer, that European settlement on the far side of the Mediterranean, won a century before the wonderful spoils of Europe's first crusade. But it's still frontier country, where strutting machismo was never out of style. Take Reynald of Châtillon. Captured by Muslims during the Second Crusade, Reynald had spent some 15 years as the guest of an Arab prison. Ransomed at huge cost to his family fortune, he came away from that experience utterly despising Arabs. Once at liberty, rather than going home where living cheek by jowl with Arab neighbors wouldn't be an issue, he stayed, married an heiress, and became Lord of Transjordan, a wild, raw, almost borderless country on the east side of the Jordan River. With it came control of spectacular Croc de Chevalier, a desert fortress that vied for the title of greatest fortification in the world. Vast, bristling with defenses, mighty Croc might be admired for its overwhelming power alone, but more to the point, it commanded the heights overlooking the main caravan route between Syria and Egypt, the two great poles of the Muslim world. Ungovernable Reynald now had both the means and the insanely aggressive temperament to maintain a steady level of intense hostility with surrounding Arab chieftains. They loathed him, and there was no shortage of reasons, ranging from his troops dispersing of rape and ruin throughout the countryside to his own habit of brightening a torpid afternoon by tossing screaming Muslim hostages from his castle windows. Treaties meant nothing to the Lord of Transjordan. There are stories that he attacked a gigantic caravan which, among other things, was ferrying a royal Muslim princess under a flag of truce. He even went after the cities of Mecca and Medina, sites so holy that non-Muslims are not permitted to step onto their soil. He was equally horrible to his own people. When the Holy Patriarch of Antioch made the sorry mistake of arguing with him, the senior churchman was summarily kidnapped and treated to a day in the broiling sun, tied down naked and coated in honey. He ignored the King of Jerusalem's insistent demand that he return every bit of what he'd captured from the caravan when he violated the truce protecting it. He was, in short, a constant plague to both Christians and Saracens, always risking outright war between the two, always jarring the European inhabitants of these ancient lands with reminders that despite the comfort of their lives, they were surrounded by potential enemies. The peace between the two sides, the peace that made life possible, was as fragile as cobwebs if left to people like Reynald. Meanwhile, back home in Europe, men had too many ripe quarrels of their own to pay much attention to what was happening on the far side of the Mediterranean. Henry Plantagenet, for example, had promised more than once to lead a crusader army of his own to the east, but never quite got around to it. Despite the tenuous condition of his cousin King Baldwin of Jerusalem, mortally sick with leprosy, appeals for assistance from beyond Byzantium were more of an embarrassment to Henry, the most powerful man in Western Europe. He had neither time nor money to worry about problems on the other side of the world when problems in his own immense backyard snapped at him like alley dogs. Then Baldwin died of his awful disease. Thoughtful men crossed themselves. They would soon prove to have had good reason. In 1187, 2 years after Baldwin had sent a delegation from Holy Jerusalem to fruitlessly beg Henry's help, the worst of the worst possible outcomes came true. Saladin, who had risen from local warlord to master of Arabia, quit making peace treaties with the Europeans and twice whipped the army of the King of Jerusalem under the shaky command of its new king, Guy of Lusignan. Saladin first beat the Europeans handily at a place called Crassan. Then he turned his attention to parched ground near the double-crested extinct volcano called the Horns of Hattin, once the setting for the Sermon on the Mount. If Crassan was bad for King Guy, Hattin was excruciating. The Christians, led by Guy himself, had been encircled with no water for 2 wretched July days by the time Saladin's men began to move up. Superb war horses became so dehydrated that they staggered to their knees and collapsed, thudding to the ground, dying where they fell. Humans fared no better, yet it's impossible to slight their courage. Guy's knights repeatedly charged the Saracen lines, despite such crushing exhaustion that if a man fell, he might not have the strength to stand up again. Brutalized by heat and thirst, outnumbered, terrified of the fires the Muslims spun through the dry grass, the Christians lost the battle, along with one of Christianity's most sacred relics, the true cross on which Jesus had died. Brutish Reynald of Chatillon wasn't simply imprisoned this time. After he was captured in this battle, Saladin personally cut off his sword arm and then had him beheaded. So many Christian prisoners were sent to the slave markets that prices collapsed. One unfortunate found himself traded for a single shoe. After his monumental victory at Hattin, Saladin consumed the Kingdom of Jerusalem the way flame would. Within 3 months, virtually every city in the country was gone. The capital itself, the holiest of Christian cities, finally surrendered on October 2, 1187, despite women shaving their daughters' heads as desperate signs of penitence for the city's sins. The great Latin state barons, along with their knights, were raked by death. In one skirmish, a contingent of Templars was reduced to 3 survivors. Those who lived through the catastrophes were sold as slaves or went into Saracen prisons. King Guy was one of them. As had been the case 50 years before when Edessa fell, launching the Second Crusade, there was a new pope on the throne of St. Peter in Saladin's wake. The new pope called himself Gregory, the 8th of that name. A thoughtful and educated man, descendant of a noble Italian family, Gregory was in his late 70s when he won the papal crown. He was anything but a raw newcomer to international crises, having headed the church's inquiry into Becket's death 15 years back. His papacy began on October 20, 1187. By then, Jerusalem itself had already fallen. But since news traveled at a walking pace, Gregory knew only of the Hattin disaster when he issued a letter to all Christendom that began, Audita tremendi severitate judici, on hearing of this incredible judgment upon us. The Pope told his world that it had so wallowed in sin that even the presence of the true cross on the battlefield at Hattin had not persuaded God to hold disaster back this time. Hattin was not an accident or a military mistake. It was a brutal punishment meted out by a justifiably angry creator. There was only one possible response, a new crusade, the third, to cleanse Christianity through suffering, poverty, pain, and death. Success marked when the true cross returned to its rightful place in Christian hands. People had barely digested the disaster at Hattin, listening with pounding hearts to Gregory's letter as it was read from every pulpit in Europe, when belated news burst over the continent that Jerusalem itself, the most prized city in Christendom, was in Saracen hands. Men in Europe saw darkest calamity. And so, in those dour autumn days of 1187, the disaster at Hattin, the loss of perhaps the greatest religious relic in Christendom, and the epic collapse of the Kingdom of Jerusalem were seen above all as punishment by an angry God for sin, an ocean of sin. It was finally time, and past time, for true penance, genuine sorrow for sins of lust, greed, and pride, signified by exposing your body, your life, your fortune to God's will on the battlefield. A crusader would start out as a penitent would, on foot. There would be no empty pomp, a sharp reminder of Eleanor and her ladies laughing as they were carried on litters across the back-breaking terrain of Anatolia. The church would again ease both worldly and spiritual concerns. If you died, you were promised a place in heaven. And as long as you were on crusade, you could be assured that every sin you confessed would be forgiven by merciful God. No one could bring a legal case against you. Taxes and interest on debt were forgiven, and the local bishop was pledged to keep an eye on your wife, your children, and your property. You could leave all behind with a light heart, because whether you lived or whether you died, your soul, your family, and your estate would be taken care of. Europeans answered the trumpet blast of Audita Tremendi by the tens of thousands. There were massive enlistment rallies across the continent, from Germany to Paris to Wales. The very first noble to swear his crusader oath was the warrior prince Richard Lionheart. Philip Augustus of France and Germany's Holy Roman Emperor Frederick Barbarossa were not long behind him. Chroniclers wrote that any male, healthy, young, and rich, cannot remain behind without suffering shame, although John Lackland was stoic in the face of this prospect, and the great knight William Marshall didn't pledge himself either, perhaps due to his age. He was 41 years old by the time of this crusade, perhaps because life as the Earl of Pembroke was simply too pleasant to risk. Preparations remembered from the Second Crusade 50 years before were renewed across the face of Europe. Feudal obligations pulled networks of men into following their lords. Supplies were laboriously accumulated. Families scrambled to raise cash and to fill worrisome gaps in management of farms, estates, counties, countries. Everyone understood with varying degrees of anxiety and excitement that they would be pitting themselves against the man then at the summit of the Muslim world, the encircling scourge of the Latin states, the conqueror of Jerusalem, infidel possessor of the true cross, Sultan of Egypt, Mesopotamia, Hejaz, Yemen, and Syria. Salal al-Dunya al-Din Yusuf ibn Ayyub. We know him to this day as Saladin. This champion of the Arab world wasn't an Arab, but a Kurd, an unusual ethnic group, Muslims to be sure, but of European descent, thus unlike any of their Arab neighbors. He was in his early 50s in 1190, 20 years older than Richard Lionheart. His background meant he was seen as something of a foreign newcomer, raising the level of suspicion and jealousy that inevitably would be leveled at his ambition, not to mention his fabulous victories. Coming up in the brutal world of Zengi's son, Nur ad-Din, Saladin had made his name as a brilliant field commander, becoming general of the Muslim armies at the age of 31, and dominant ruler of the Middle East soon thereafter. He possessed the charisma to meld autocratic tribal chiefs from 1,000 points in Arabia into a cohesive army that won battle after battle. At home, his patronage extended to a 12th century version of a modern war college, staffed by experts in military administration, and even the psychology of warfare. He did have some flaws as a general, chief among them hesitation in committing himself if he wasn't certain of possessing the strongest force. But his prowess at both war and diplomacy succeeded in uniting strategically important Syria with economically powerful Egypt for the first time in centuries. His taking Jerusalem in 1187 was breathtaking. If Europeans had been ignorant of him before, his name was now known to everyone from the coast of Ireland to the streets of Constantinople. Many fellow Arabs found him to be thoughtful, intelligent, curious about the world, an extremely devout follower of Islam, a first-rate judge of horseflesh. He loved to stay up late talking theology or listening to poets, was lame in one leg, and rather surprisingly delicate, attended at times by more than 20 doctors. He was certainly different from his predecessors, the raging Zengi and Nur ad-Din. There's a story in Simon Montefiore's book Jerusalem that a sobbing Latin states mother came to him pleading for the return of her baby daughter, who'd been stolen in a Muslim raid. He cried with her, immediately sending messengers off to find her child. He tended to spare Christian battle captives and was said to have told his sons not to kill prisoners because he didn't want his boys getting too comfortable with shedding blood. As modern historian Jeffrey Reagan commented, when one considers the sort of men Saladin faced, such as Reynald of Chantillon, one can only wonder at how he maintained such a generous spirit. At first, the European chroniclers took the opposite view of this deadly enemy of their faith, denouncing Saladin as a low-born braggart, accused of malicious cruelty combined with personal cowardice. However, his treatment of Jerusalem after he won it softened Western assessments. When the First Crusade took the city from the Arabs back in 1099, the Europeans massacred everything that moved within its walls. So much Muslim blood soaked into the ground, the very stones, that the city still reeked of it months later. Saladin's triumph 90 years later was gracious by contrast, with remarkably little violence and ready permission for Christians to visit their religious sites, largely left intact, in contrast to Christian treatment of Muslim holy places, which had long been defiled with every kind of filth. When Saladin took the city, a Muslim caravan bringing casks of rose water arrived, Saladin's sister and other dignitaries rolling their sleeves up to scrub their shrines clean. Europeans who had the opportunity to meet the man in person were impressed. The Bishop of Salisbury, having been a guest of the Sultan's, said that if Saladin's virtues could somehow be combined with Richard Lionheart's, the result would be a monarch so incomparable that his like would not be found anywhere on earth. Westerners therefore spoke respectfully of the Sultan's chivalrous virtues, including generosity to guests, learned conversation with emissaries, and tolerant consideration toward pilgrims. European interest in him lasted for generations after his death. A century later, Dante would think to place him among the ranks of virtuous pagans in his Divine Comedy. When poets tried to imagine a suitable male figure to pair with legendary Eleanor of Aquitaine in their stories, the choice often was no European prince, but this singular king of the East, Saladin. Like Richard Lionheart, Saladin controlled an empire of huge scope, although the word controlled is admittedly an overstatement. Unlike his European peers, he had no God-given right to rule by inheritance. Saladin's dominance from the Nile Basin to the banks of the Tigris depended upon force of personality combined with successes at war that translated into booty for his followers. If the Ultramare was notorious for its feeble alliances, the Muslim world of 1,000 local chieftains was even more fragmented, more aggressive, more envious, and competitive. The Egyptians were jealous of the Syrians. The Persians thought themselves superior to the Yemenis. The Mesopotamians had no regard for the Egyptians, and at various times, everyone was furious at what they considered Saladin's negligence of their needs. Even in his own extended family, ambitions to dethrone him were combined with dark suspicions of his plans. Rivals were notoriously short-tempered. There was a bloody brawl between one army loyal to Saladin and a second belonging to the Caliph of Baghdad, Saladin's nominal overlord and supposed ally, that broke out while each was escorting pilgrims to Holy Mecca. During the Crusader death struggle with Saladin over Acre, the Caliph of Morocco allowed European ships to catch their breath in his harbors before they headed further east. At one point, anti-Saladin animosity was so marked in Aleppo that local Syrians hired the assassin cult to kill him. Even when actual bloodshed wasn't involved, resentment fueled by jealousy produced little but shrugs in response to Saladin's constant and very real need for extensive financial and military help. To be able to govern at all in such a blistering place, he needed a truly exceptional ability to variously cajole, flatter, frighten, reassure, and lead, combined with an equal ability to rain plunder on his undependable friends. Unfortunately for Saladin, winning Jerusalem, as central to Islam as it was to Christianity, Muslims believe that they will face Judgment Day from the place in Jerusalem called the Dome of the Rock. His great victory ironically weakened his hold on his allies, who murmured to one another that with Jerusalem's riches at hand, he couldn't possibly have any more need for their armies and their money. Yet, even if no one else saw it, he understood that while the Latin states had been savagely hurt, they were still breathing and would inevitably bring a new crusade to his lands. He held the ports on the Mediterranean coast, Jerusalem, and most of Palestine. But Tripoli and Antioch were still in Western hands, along with scattered European forts that could become alarming problems behind his lines. He couldn't pay attention to every possible threat, but he should have paid more attention than he did to Tyre in what's now Lebanon, another Mediterranean port as old as the world, harking back to the days even before the Babylonians. The city rested on a tiny rocky island that shouldered the Syrian coast about 100 miles south of Tripoli, artificially joined to the mainland by a narrow causeway built by many, many generations of very hard work. Tyre was so ancient that the Assyrians had fought for control of it thousands of years before Christ was born. Biblical Jezebel had been carried through its streets by strapping litter bearers as people gaped at her glorious face. The West had stubbornly controlled it for the last 65 years, delighting in its gorgeous, not to mention ruinously expensive, plum purple dyes. Because it was still in Western hands, Tyre provided the beleaguered Latin states with access to the sea, to Constantinople, to Europe. It was a genuine threat to Saladin and the Muslim world. Saladin should have snapped Tyre up after Hattin, but he didn't. That omission would cost him. The city had recently come under the very firm command of a newly arrived 40-something Italian nobleman named Conrad, Marquis of Montferrat. Related to the rulers of France and Germany, and brother-in-law to Queen Sibylla of Jerusalem, Conrad was quite the ambitious adventurer. He happened to be the brother of Queen Sibylla's first husband, who died before King Baldwin. If things had gone a bit differently in the mortality sweepstakes, that first husband would have outlived Baldwin and likely become the next king of Jerusalem. It didn't happen, but Conrad's notable relationship with the throne of Jerusalem gave him considerable status in the Outremer. He'd recently decided to say his goodbyes to Constantinople, motivated by gossip that his fingerprints were all over a suspicious political murder. He arrived in Tyre shortly after the Hattin debacle, finding the city in about the condition one might expect when the greatest enemy army in that part of the world had just won a crushing victory. The city's leadership was in turmoil, the population in panic. Saladin's flags had actually been planted on some of Tyre's walls. Made of very stern stuff indeed, Conrad recognized the opportunity that can lurk in the shadow of disaster, and willingly stepped into Tyre's political and military void, going so far as to rip Saladin's flags down himself. Luckily for its citizens, Conrad turned out to be just as forceful, smart, and energetic as those first hours hinted he might be. One duly impressed Muslim chronicler described him as a devil incarnate in his ability to govern and defend a town, a man of extraordinary courage. Very soon, that courage would be put to the test. Saladin had neglected to take Tyre after Hattin. He now saw it for the mistake it was, a mistake he intended to fix. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knabb. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again, October 21st, for the next episode of Lion's Forge. Available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.